Thanks for having me. It's good to be here. I'll be here for the rest of the week, so I'd be more than happy to talk about this more offline if you guys have any questions, and I'd be happy to hear more about the work you guys are doing here. So today I want to tell you about work that I've been doing for the past year, year and a half, with Liam Fitzpatrick at Stanford, and then Jared Kaplan, and recently Junpu Wang, both of whom are at Johns Hopkins. And this will be on drawing on papers that we've from last year, from January, and then also that last paper should hopefully be on archive tomorrow. So you guys are getting fresh, hot off the press work. So the framework that we're going to be working in is ADS-CFT. Now, I'm sure everyone has heard about ADS-CFT, but just to say the one-line description, I'll get into more details later. But we're just considering a map or a correspondence between theories of gravity in anti-de Sitter space, and then a special class of quantum field theories known as conformal field theories, which are living in a flat space-time in one fewer dimensions. And so for the entirety of this talk, I will always use the letter D to refer to the number of space-time dimensions for the conformal field theory, and then ADS will be in D plus 1. And ADS-CFT is old news. There's been plenty of excellent work done on it. What we're specifically going to be interested in is studying long-distance physics in ADS. And the reason what we're doing this is for two reasons. Long-distance physics in ADS is going to be is very universal. And what do I mean by this? I mean, at very, very long distances, we have a large amount of very robust predictions for what physics should look like. We expect things like Gauss's law, Newtonian gravity, Weinberg-Soff theorems. So we have a very large handle on what to expect from ADS physics at long distances. And then it's also weakly coupled. And what I mean by that is just the statement that interactions fall off at large separation. And when I say large separation, I'm talking very, very macroscopic, like astronomically large separations. And so I expect that if I take two objects and I bring them far apart, the interactions will fall off with separation. And so at sufficiently large separation, long distance locality, which is just the statement I just made about interactions falling off at large distance, provides a universal perturbative expansion for CFT. If I know what the CFT equivalent is of long distance physics in ADS, then I have a perturbative parameter, just 1 over the separation between my objects, that I can use to study the CFT and have control, even in a very strongly coupled conformal field theory. And so the perspective we're going to take today is we're going to use our ADS intuition. We're going to have a nice, simple, conceptual picture in ADS, and that's going to guide our conformal field theory derivations. So everything I'm going to tell you about today can be derived solely from a conformal field theory in the sense that it could have been derived 40 years ago without any reference to ADS-CFT. So I'm going to make no assumptions about the ADS description. I'm not going to assume anything about the physics there. I'm just going to use it as an intuitive guide. And as we'll see, it'll provide the most natural interpretation of the CFT theorems that I'll talk about today. So we're going to hopefully cover a lot of ground. So I'm just going to give you the punchline right out the gate. Our results are going to be divided into two camps. The first is going to be in conformal field theories in 3 or higher dimensions, so ADS in 4 and higher dimensions. And the statement will be that all conformal field theories have a universal large spin structure, I'll make this more concrete later, which is consistent with macro locality in ADS. So the statement is that every single conformal field theory in 3 dimensions or higher has a structure, has a spectrum of operators with coefficients, with couplings, that is consistent or totally matches the macro locality statement in ADS that interactions fall off at long distances. And not only do the interactions fall off, we can actually parameterize exactly how they fall off, and they match our Gauss's law type intuition from ADS. And then the second statement I'm going to make is I'm going to go to 2 dimensions, so 3-dimensional ADS. And in this case, the behavior is going to be slightly different, and so we're going to have to specialize to a class of theories, which are those with large central charge. But even though we're going to specialize to a smaller subset of conformal field theories, we're going to find much more powerful results. We're going to find that operators with large scaling dimension create classical backgrounds for operators with small dimension. This totally matches our gravitational intuition from ADS with the idea of having very heavy objects like the Earth creating classical backgrounds for operators with very light masses, these light probes. But the surprising thing is that we're going to have this very intuitive gravitational-like structure in a conformal field theory that never makes reference to gravity. Yes, absolutely. No,
but just to clarify, you would not expect that any CFT has a classical ADS.
So I'm not saying that every single CFT like has some classical dual. All I'm saying is that any, and there's one caveat for the D greater than equal to 3, is the CFT has to be unitary. All I'm saying is just that any unitary CFT has a spectrum of operators that is consistent with what you would interpret as very, very long distance physics in ADS. It doesn't mean that they have some sort of dual. I'm just saying that they have a structure that matches what you would expect. So I'll make this more concrete, then we can see. But yeah, I'm not trying to make any bold claim. I'm really just trying to say something about just the structure of operators and CFTs. But yeah. Yeah.
Are you going to need a large n limit?
No, I will not need it. So this large central charge is basically going to be equivalent to the large n limit in the 2D, but in 3D, no. I will find a spectrum of operators at large spin that is totally consistent with what you would expect from large n, but I'm never going to assume it. Except in 2D. So the outline of what I'm going to do is first I'm just going to give a very brief review of just those few highlights of ADS-CFT that we need, just that way we're all working with the same dictionary and we understand the picture that I'm using. Then I'm going to talk about this idea of cluster decomposition or macro locality from the CFT perspective and studying long distance interactions in CFTs in three or higher dimensions. Then I'm going to give a very, very brief review of conformal field theories in two dimension and gravity in three dimensions. I'm really just going to highlight just two features of these theories that are going to be relevant for our discussion. Then I'm going to talk about the statement I made about how operators with large scaling dimension create classical backgrounds. And what we're going to find is that this is going to have a very nice interpretation in terms of black hole thermality and studying black holes in the ADS, in the three-dimensional ADS picture. Then I'll talk about just the implications of these results and a lot of future directions that we're trying to work on or thinking about. Good. So first, let's start with ADS. ADS, like I said, is going to be in D plus one dimensions. And you can literally just think of it as gravity in a box. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is that it has some non-trivial curvature scale associated with the radius of curvature RADS, which for the entirety of this talk, I'll set to 1. This non-trivial curvature creates a gravitational well to where everything wants to fall towards the center of ADS. Okay? And then when I say it's in a box, I mean that it has some well-defined boundary and that particles can reach the boundary in a finite amount of proper time. And so it's literally just a very fancy box with a gravitational well pulling things towards the center. There's the various generators associated with the isometries of ADS. The most important one that I'm going to be, the only one really that I'm going to be paying attention to is going to be the Hamiltonian, which generates time translations. So on this picture right here, time translations just go vertically. And then I have a D-dimensional slice. So the Hamiltonian just evolves me up on this kind of soup can picture. And then I'm going to be talking about what I'm going to be calling very loosely objects. When I say object, what I really mean is just some energy eigenstate, just some eigenstate of the Hamiltonian that has some well-defined energy. That's all we need for ADS. On the conformal field theory side, this lives in a flat space-time with one fewer dimensions. And one of the important pieces of conformal field theories that I'm going to need is what's known as the operator-state correspondence. And so every single state in a conformal field theory can be written in terms of local operators acting on the vacuum. And so I'm going to be using these terms operators and states very interchangeably. Anytime I say operator, you can either think of it as just the operator or the state of being created by that operator. Conformal field theories are invariant under the conformal group. And the important generator that I'm going to care about is dilatation, so scale transformation, zooming in and out. I'm again going to be talking about the eigenstates of this dilatation operator, which have some associated eigenvalue, which is just their scaling dimension, which is just the scaling dimension of the operator associated with that state. And so much like the Hamiltonian evolves me on d-dimensional slices forward in time, in radial quantization, I can think of the dilatation operator as my Hamiltonian evolving me on spherical shells outwards. The last important tool that we'll need for conformal field theories is the operator product expansion, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with. In conformal field theories, this is an exact statement that I can take two operators at some finite separation and write them as a sum of single operators acting at some point with some associated function. I'm just going to use a pointer. With some associated function that is some function of the distance between these two original operators and then derivatives of that position. And this function right here is completely fixed by symmetry. This is completely fixed by conformal symmetry. The only piece that I have that's free is some overall coefficient out front. Okay? And these overall coefficients are theory dependent. And in general, the statement is that a CFT is defined by its set of operators, their scaling dimensions, and their OPE coefficients. If you hand me those two things, that's telling me everything there is to know about the CFT. Good. So ADS CFT is many things to many people, but the main feature that I'm going to be focusing on is this idea of it's an equivalence between the Hilbert space of some theory of gravity in ADS and the Hilbert space of some conformal field theory. And so I'm saying that these are just simply distinct descriptions of the exact same Hilbert space. And when I say a correspondence of Hilbert space, what I'm really saying is a correspondence of states. For every state in ADS, there's a corresponding state in the conformal field theory. And so I'm going to be mapping energy eigenstates in the ADS picture to dilatation eigenstates, or to operators, in the conformal field theory. So this is the basic dictionary that we have. Like I just said, objects are going to map to operators in the CFT. And the reason I'm using a very ambiguous word object is because I'm trying to not assume anything specific about the structure of my theory in ADS. It could very well be that I have a nice, very, very local particle or string or any sort of description in ADS, but I don't want to assume that for right now. I just want to make very, very general statements about objects associated with energy eigenstates. They could be very, very non-local blobs. Hamiltonian, so time translations in ADS, are going to be associated with scaling transformations in the CFT. So I'm going to map the Hamiltonian to dilatations, which means that energies of these objects in ADS just map to scaling dimensions of their corresponding operator in the CFT. And then lastly, I'm going to be talking a lot about angular momentum. So the angular momentum of some object in ADS just maps to the spin of the associated operator in the conformal field theory. And so for our purposes, this is all that we're going to need for ADS CFT. So what I want to do is I want to study objects at large separation. I want to study things at long distance. And what I really want to study is the following. Suppose in ADS you hand me two separate energy eigenstates, so two different objects, which I'm calling OH and OL. Those are referring to some heavy object and some light object. For right now, this doesn't matter that they're heavy and light, but it will soon. So if you hand me two energy eigenstates, then our naive expectation is that there are additional energy eigenstates that correspond to two object states where they're at very, very large separation. So I'd expect to find in my Hilbert space states that correspond to OH over here on this side of the universe and some OL over on the other side of the universe. And I would expect that the binding energy between these two objects to vanish as the separation between them goes to zero. And so the equivalent statement in ADS, oh no, good. First, let's say one more thing. And if I want to keep them at some fixed distance, like I said, ADS has a gravitational well that's trying to pull things in. And so if I just put two objects at rest at very, very large separation, that configuration isn't stable and they're going to fall towards each other. So the way to keep them at fixed distance is to give them some sort of angular momentum. So they have, very naively, you can just think of this as just the centrifugal force keeping them outwards. And so I just have two objects orbiting around ADS at some fixed distance. And as shown in the bottom over there, the separation between them just grows as the logarithm of their angular momentum. Now, I want to stress that what's keeping these two objects in orbit is not gravitational interactions between them. It's just the curvature of the background that they're propagating in. This is literally equivalent in a flat spacetime picture to just two objects moving past each other at some fixed velocity. And it's just the curvature of ADS that gives it this nice stable configuration of these two objects orbiting at some fixed radius. So good. So I want to study objects with very, very large angular momentum, which corresponds to large separation. Well, the corresponding picture on the CFT side will be that there are some operators with very, very large spin. And so the claim is, or what I would expect, is given two operators, OH and OL, just go to the next page. Given two operators, OH and OL, then I expect that there are additional operators, which I'm going to call double trace operators just because they're very reminiscent in structure to these large N expectations, but I'm not assuming anything like that. All I'm saying is that there exist operators with a very specific scaling dimension, and that scaling dimension is the following. Let me go back. The scaling dimension is the scaling dimension of H, so the energy of H, its rest mass, the scaling dimension of L, a term that looks like the kinetic energy. L parameterizes their angular momentum. N is parameterizing some relative motion of the two. And then some last piece, which I'm going to call the anomalous dimension. It's literally just defined as the difference between this scaling dimension and this piece right here. And you can associate this physically with just the binding energy of these two objects in ADS. So the claim is that I expect some spectrum of operators at large spin with scaling dimensions of exactly this form. And I expect that as L goes to infinity, as I go to higher and higher spin operators, I expect this anomalous dimension, this binding energy, to vanish. And this was proven by a large number of people. It was actually, amusingly enough, Callan and Gross, back in, I think, the 70s, wrote a paper that basically had exactly this result. But there was a lot of work by a very large number of people over the past few years that have proven that all unitary CFTs in three or higher dimensions have this exact structure. For every single two pairs of operators, there's a whole tower of large spin operators that have exactly this behavior, that their anomalous dimension vanishes as L goes to infinity. And you can interpret the rate at which this anomalous dimension goes to infinity as telling me something as going goes to zero as the rate at which long-range forces are dying off. Yes?
For theories that really did have a gravity duel, you'd make a prediction for precisely how gamma falls off with L.
Exactly.
Presumably, most CFTs don't satisfy that prediction. Do you actually know what the bounds are?
So good. So good. So let me go two more slides, and I could say. But it's literally set by, if I look at the operators that are in the OPE of OH and OL, it's the lowest twist operators that set the rate at which that falls off. So if there's anything with a lower twist than the stress energy tensor, then I have corrections that fall off less rapidly than gravitationally. But yeah, you'll see more in just a second. Yes?
An intuitive reason why the L divergence is linear, or?
Oh, why this piece right here is linear? So from the CFT, so good. If I want to think about this in some like large N, I don't know if this will give you intuition, but if I want to think about this as literally, how do I take some operator, two operators, OH and OL, and make some operator with large spin? I just take OH, OL, act with a large number of derivatives. And then so you can just see that this is each derivative is adding one layer of spin and one thing of scaling dimension. But that's it.
Do we really expect these to be exact energy eigenstates? Because in reality, there will be gravitational.
So what's happening, it's a slightly confusing picture. But I could remove one of these guys and just send one object, like sending through ADS. And it will also follow a stable orbit. And the reason it's not radiating is because it's just I can do a bulk isometry, an ADS isometry, and just go to the frame where this guy's at rest, where he's not accelerating. He's just moving with some constant velocity through some non-trivial background. Does that kind of make sense? Like this is, you can literally just think of this as two things going with fixed velocity. But yes, exactly. It's just a geodesic orbit, so they're not the. You're right that as they're like at finite separation, there will be effects from things radiating off, but there are stable or like totally stable energy eigenstates associated with. But yeah, that's a good question. Good, okay. So now the really interesting meat of this is not the fact that interactions fall off, but how can we study this anomalous dimension? Well, in ADS, we have a nice simple picture. How do I study binding energies between two objects? I could just study their scattering in ADS. I could extract out information about their binding energy associated with the operator, the objects that they exchange, the part like. At long distances, this is dominated by massless or very, very light objects. So the exchange of very heavy objects in ADS would be suppressed at very long distances. So there's going to be a similar intuition in the CFT. What I want to do is I want to study some operator that contributes to both the OPE of OHOH and the OPE of OLOL. I'm calling this schematically T because I'm mostly going to be talking about the stress energy tensor, but this could be any operator that's in the OPE of both OH with itself and OL with itself. And then if I can calculate the contribution of this observable to this four-point function, which I can think of as reminiscent as the 2-to-2 ADS scattering I would be doing if I lived in ADS, then that can determine the anomalous dimension, the contribution to the anomalous dimension due to T. So what we're going to be doing is might seem somewhat technical, but it has a very, very nice, simple, obvious analogy in terms of scattering. In scattering, if I take just two objects that have some T-channel exchange where they exchange some light mediator, then I have a T-channel pole in the forward scattering limit when theta goes to zero. I could do a partial wave expansion of this scattering, and what I notice is that every single term in this partial wave expansion is perfectly well behaved in this theta goes to zero limit. And so how can this sum possibly reproduce this theta goes to zero singularity? It's simply a statement that there are an infinite number of partial waves, and the full sum is actually divergent. It's dominated by the L goes to infinity pieces. And those pieces perfectly reproduce this singularity right here. So by studying the singularity of a very specific kinematic limit, I can, by studying the divergence as theta goes to zero, I can determine and constrain, or I can determine the coefficients for these large spin partial waves as L goes to infinity. That's exactly the same thing we're going to be doing in ADS, in conformal field theories. And the way we're going to be doing this is by using a very, very powerful tool known as the conformal bootstrap. The conformal bootstrap sounds like a very trivial statement, but it's highly constraining. So I could take this four-point function right here, so O heavy, O heavy with O light, O light. And then I can do a partial wave decomposition. So I can take OHOH and then do some sum over intermediate states, which I then just group into representations of the conformal group, so just some partial wave decomposition, and then have them go to OLOL. Or I could do a different decomposition where I insert a complete set of states in between OHOL and OHOL. And the conformal bootstrap is literally just the statement that these two decompositions must be the same. Now, this might seem very trivial, but it's actually a very powerful constraint on the possible scaling dimensions of operators and OP coefficients that you can have in your theory. So if you hand me some just random collection of scaling dimensions and OP coefficients, that cannot be, very generically, that will not be a conformal field theory. It has to satisfy this very non-trivial constraint. And the reason it's not trivial is because this holds, there's a separate bootstrap equation for every single correlation function I can build in this theory. These partial waves that I'm decomposing my correlation function into are called conformal blocks. They're just functions of the positions of these four external operators, and specifically they're functions of these cross ratios. So I'm just going to be using the coordinate z and z bar because that'll be most intuitive to use. These are just cross ratios. These are defined in terms of cross ratios of positions. And so different values of z and z bar are just different relative positions of the various operators. I'm going to be studying this in a very specific limit, which is called the light cone OPE limit. It's the statement that z goes to 0 and z bar goes to 1. So what does this mean? So I'm going to pick coordinates such that OH and OH are totally fixed, okay? And then I'm just going to consider the relative position of OL and OL. If I look at one of the pieces of OL, then I can define the position of the other guy on with respect to the light cone of OL. Z bar just parameterizes directions along one light cone coordinate. Z just parameterizes position along the other. And so the z goes to 0 limit is just this object approaches the light cone, and then z bar parameterizes how far along it is. And so the main important thing is I'm mostly just going to be interested in z goes to 0 at fixed z bar, but occasionally I'll need to take the limit that z bar goes to a very specific position. But schematically, this is the picture we're going to take. We're just going to take OL and put him on the light cone of the other light guy. Okay, so now we do this decomposition in one channel where we go from OHOH to OLOL, and then we just sum over all possible intermediate states. Well, the simplest possible intermediate state is the vacuum, which just gives wick propagation, just wick contraction. So just, if you want to think about it, just a product of two-point functions. Then there are corrections from the exchange of various operators. And so I'm going to write this sum schematically in the following form. There's an overall coefficient here. This coefficient is going to be important because we're going to see that it's singular when z goes to 0. This is going to be equivalent to our theta goes to 0 singularity from the partial wave analogy I gave you before. This wick contraction is trivial. It just gives an overall factor of 1. And all you need to care about for this is just the fact that other conformal blocks are suppressed by powers of z to this combination delta t minus lt. This combination of scaling dimension minus spin is called the twist. Unitarity bounds it from below to where this contribution will always vanish when z goes to 0. And so what we see is that in the limit z goes to 0, the wick contraction piece dominates, and all other pieces are subleading. And then if we want to consider these subleading corrections, it's going to be dominated by those operators with lowest twist. OK. So this is in one decomposition where I went from OHOH to OLOL. Let's do the other decomposition. Let's go from OHOL to OHOL. Well, what's going to be included in this is those double trace operators I talked about before, those operators that look like two objects at large separation in ADS. And so what we'll see is that, like I pointed out on the previous slide, there's an overall singularity of 1 over z to this power. And each individual block in this other channel is at most logarithmically divergent. So this equation right here is just like the t-channel scattering that we had before, where we have a singularity for the overall correlation function, but each individual piece cannot reproduce, is less singular, less divergent. So by studying the behavior as z goes to 0, I can constrain the large L behavior of these operators. And so I can determine, one, that they have exactly the scaling dimensions I would expect. They look like piece from H, piece from L, and then the anomalous dimension. I can show that the anomalous dimension vanishes, which you can see really obviously from this picture, where this has no z-bar dependence. And the z-bar dependence is set by gamma. And so this very schematically shows you that gamma must vanish. The subleading corrections associated with the lower twist operators that have some non-trivial z-bar dependence, those fix the behavior as gamma goes to infinity. Or as gamma goes to 0 and as L goes to infinity. And so what they match is they match our intuition from ADS. Okay, so let's consider the equivalent statement in ADS. In ADS, I just am doing 2-to-2 scattering of O heavy scattering off of O light. They're exchanging some object associated with the low twist operators in the conformal blocks. And what I find is that for the lowest twist block, so I just take some lowest twist operator, it has some coefficient here, PT, which is just a theory-dependent coefficient. The anomalous dimension resulting from this guy just looks like the coefficient over some power of L to the twist of this operator. So this is what's telling you that the lowest twist guys are the dominant piece. Okay? Now first, this satisfies two sanity checks. One, it vanishes when L goes to infinity. But more importantly, it perfectly matches our intuition from ADS. Let's consider the stress energy tensor, T. This is a ubiquitous operator in conformal field theories, and it's dual to gravitational interactions in ADS. So if I plug in these corresponding pieces, the coefficient and the twist for the stress energy tensor, I find a coefficient like this that scales with the scaling dimension of H and L over this factor C, which is just some universal coefficient for the stress energy tensor, and it falls like 1 over L to the D minus 2. Well, this perfectly matches the behavior I would expect from gravitational interactions. These deltas just correspond to energies or rest masses, and so it looks like MH, ML. It's got an overall factor G, which is just equivalent to this factor 1 over C. And then it falls off like L to this very specific power D minus 2. Like I said before, L parameterizes the distance between these two objects. And so this thing falls off like R to the D minus 2. Okay, so just to summarize, because I've already covered a lot. If I have any two operators in a CFT, there's a corresponding tower of operators that correspond to objects at large separation. They have a fixed scaling dimension as the spin goes to infinity. And the anomalous dimension is just set by the coefficients and the twists of the lowest twist operators in the OPE of OHOH and OLOL. Okay, now I specifically said that this was true for CFTs in 3 dimensions or higher. But why is D equals 2 special? Why does this proof not hold for D equals 2? You can kind of already start to see it here just by the fact that the scaling behavior had a very specific power. But for D greater than or equal to 3, any non-trivial operator has a twist that is greater than 0. So the only twist 0 state is just the vacuum. And so what this means then is that, one, I can separate Wick contraction from everybody else, and that B, there's going to be just a finite number of leading contributions to gamma of NL. For D equals 2, this isn't true. The unitarity bound no longer limits twists all the way up to 0, so there are actually infinitely many operators that have twist equal to 0. What this means is that I can't even isolate that trivial piece that just corresponded to Wick contraction, which means that, as we'll see, the anomalous dimension actually doesn't vanish in 2D. Okay? Now this will have a nice simple interpretation in 3D gravity, but we'll get to that in just a second. So this is the basic schematic reason why D equals 2 is different. But more generally, or this is very relatedly, conformal field theories in 2 dimension look very, very different. The general definition of conformal transformations are just transformations that preserve angles, so I just take the metric and rescale it by some function of position. And if I look at 2D, I can write it in light cone or holomorphic, anti-holomorphic coefficients, coordinates, to where ds squared just looks like the product of dz, dz bar. And I see that if I take one coordinate z to any function of z, and z bar to any function of z bar, then this just looks like a conformal transformation. It's just the original metric multiplied by some overall multiplicative function. And so what this means then is that conformal transformations in 2D correspond to any function, any change of coordinates that's just any function of z and z bar. And so in 2D conformal field theories, I actually have an infinite dimensional Virasoro symmetry that's much more powerful than the conformal structure in higher dimensions. And so for every operator in the CFT, it's related to a large number of what are called Virasoro descendants. So these are the original operator with any power of T mu nu, the stress energy tensor, multiplied by it. Okay? So now I have a whole tower of an infinite tower of operators that are all related that I can't just isolate and just talk about this O. I have to include all possible contributions from any powers of T mu nu involved. Well, the good news, so the bad news is that adding these T's is free of charge, they add no twist, and so I have to include all of them. So I have an infinite number of contributions to consider. I can't isolate some finite number of them if I want to study the conformal bootstrap. But These contributions are all related by symmetry, and so I can combine them into what are called Virasoro blocks. These are just analogous to the conformal blocks or the conformal partial waves. In higher DCFTs, they just have more structure. So just like before, these functions are totally fixed by symmetry, and so I can take any correlation function, decompose it into these structures that are fixed by symmetry with theory-dependent coefficients. The difference is the following. There's no closed-form expression for these Virasoro blocks. So unlike before, where I could decompose it into global into conformal blocks that I knew the structure of, there's no known expression for these Virasoro blocks. You can solve for them in the sense that theoretically you could just calculate all of these contributions. But at a practical level, we need to know what the structure of these blocks are to make any progress. Okay, before I talk about, so what we're going to do is we're literally just going to compute Virasoro blocks. That's our main result. But the interpretation and the use of them is going to be very powerful. But before I talk about our calculation, let's just go through really briefly what do we expect, because the structure of 3D gravity is very different from that of higher D gravity. So physics in ADS3 is very binary in the sense that there's a threshold of m equals 1 over 8g, where g is just Newton's constant, so 1/8 of m Planck. And if I consider any object that has a mass less than this threshold, so less than 1 over 8g, then it creates a deficit angle in ADS. So if I have some heavy object sitting at the center of ADS, everywhere around this looks locally like ADS, but just with some wedge removed, to where if I have some light probe trying to orbit around this guy, it takes less than an angle of 2 pi to get all the way around. But everywhere locally, it still just looks like ADS, so it just looks like I'm on some cone. Now, the deficit angle in this deficit angle associated with this wedge just scales with the mass of this object. And as I dial up the mass, the deficit gets larger. And then I can cross this threshold to where now I consider an object with m above m Planck over 8. And what I find is that if I just look at classical GR, any object with a mass above this threshold is just a black hole. They're called BTZ black holes just because the paper that was originally, the people who originally discovered them were just BT and Z. But you can just think of them just as analogous to Schwarzschild black holes in higher dimension, but just the 3D corresponding. And most importantly, they look precisely just like Schwarzschild black holes in that they have a Hawking radiation with an approximately black body spectrum, and the temperature associated with the spectrum is set by the mass of this black hole. So the picture is very simple. I have some heavy object in the center. It's a deficit angle. If I dial up the mass, the deficit angle gets larger until eventually I hit the threshold where it becomes a black hole. Great. So I have a nice simple expectation of what I expect to find. And now let's try and see if we can reproduce this on the conformal field theory side. So we're going to study theories in what's known as the semi-classical limit. And what this is going to correspond to is I'm going to take the central charge to infinity. Now, the central charge just mapped to the Planck scale in ADS. So this is equivalent to sending to Newton's constant to 0. So I'm just taking the very weak gravity limit, the very semi-classical gravity limit. I'm going to do it in a very specific limit, where I keep the scaling dimension of my heavy operator, the ratio with respect to C, fixed. So this guy, as C goes to infinity, this guy's scaling dimension is going to go to infinity at a comparable rate. And then I'm going to keep the scaling dimension of my light probe fixed, okay? So I'm going to have some scaling dimension that's very small with respect to C, and some scaling dimension that's of order C. And so this will be my heavy source, and this will be my light probe. Okay. If I didn't scale delta H up with C, and I just kept both scaling dimensions fixed and took C to infinity, what I'd be doing is I'd be sending G to 0, so I'd be shutting off all gravitational interactions. So there'd be no contributions, there'd be no contributions from these Virasoro descendants. So this would be trivial. This would just say that Virasoro blocks just reduce to nice, simple, global conformal blocks which are known, and this would, in ADS, only correspond to the exchange of a single object. This is trivial and not interesting in the sense that it's not telling me about gravity. This is just saying, what happens if I turn off gravity in ADS? I know the structure of the Virasoro block. But if I keep this ratio G times MH, or equivalently delta H over C, fixed as I take G to 0 or C to infinity, then I do have gravitational interactions. My Virasoro block includes not just the exchange of this single object that was present in what's known as the global block, but also any possible gravitational interactions in ADS. And so this is what I'm trying to calculate. I want to calculate this function because it will tell me about gravitational interactions in ADS. Now, I want to consider all the contributions from T mu nu. These are all the Virasoro descendants. And so I'm going to be evaluating things that look like this. where I had OHOH and then OLOL. I insert intermediate set of states. This includes T mu nu. And so I'll have a contribution from something that looks like this three-point function. Now, this three-point function is totally fixed, including the overall coefficient. It just has this nice, simple structure. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to perform a coordinate transformation. I'm going to take z to some function of z. Okay? I know precisely how t transforms. It has this one piece right here that's simply multiplicative. This is the transformation of so-called primary operators. But t is a Virasoro descendant. And so it has a second contribution, which is known as the Schwarzian derivative. A much more intuitive way to understand this is just that this is the standard piece associated with coordinate transformations. And then this is associated with the fact that t now has a non-trivial vacuum expectation value in this new background, this new metric that I've created with this change of coordinates. But what's important is that these two pieces are additive. Okay? So now if I look at that correlation function again, I do this coordinate transformation, I get two pieces. The regular piece that's just the old guy multiplied by some function, and then a second piece associated with the VEV of t in this background. I can pick w of z, this new coordinate, such that this cancels, such that this piece totally cancels this piece. This fixes what function w I need. It's just this nice, simple rescaling z to the alpha, where alpha is just set by the scaling dimension of delta h, the heavy operator right here. And what I find is that in this coordinate w, this three-point function vanishes by construction. That's why I chose w such that this was true. But what's very powerful is that Virasoro symmetry, the infinite dimensional conformal group that I have, relates correlation functions with 1t to correlations and functions involving any powers of t. And so by killing this guy, I've killed any interaction involving t. Now, technically, this is only going to be true as c goes to infinity, but that's the limit that I want to be taking. And so in this coordinate system, I can trivialize interactions with t. And all I have to do is just alter the background metric. Yes? Ah, good, yes. So the exciting piece is going to be when alpha is not real. But yes, for like, give me just two slides, and then we can, yeah. And then, yeah, you can ask your question again. But yes, so good. The fact that this has, like an upper bound to when it becomes imaginary is going to be exactly that transition between deficit angles and black holes. Yes. But good, yeah, that's the most exciting part. So good. So what am I saying? What I'm saying is that when I take c to infinity, if I keep this ratio delta h over c, this scaling dimension delta l, and then the twist of any exchanged operator associated with a Virasoro block, if I keep these three things fixed as c goes to infinity, then the full Virasoro block is simply the same thing as a global block, but in modified coordinates. What's important is two things. One, we know the form of this. So we know exactly the form of these functions in this c goes to infinity limit. But what's more important is that I've trivialized all interactions with t. I've removed them. And so Virasoro blocks are simply global conformal blocks in a modified background metric, which means that if I consider all these exchanges of t's, if I do all this very complicated calculation of all possible contributions of t to a correlation function, it's just the same as living on a different background. Okay? This perfectly matches our gravitational kind of intuition of just this heavy object via gravitational interactions sources some classical background for the light operator to propagate through. Okay, so does this match our intuition? Does this match what we would expect from ADS? So let's first, So what did we do? We took z and took to some power z to the alpha. What this does is this just cuts a chunk out of the space in the sense that z is proportional to e to the I theta, and so now it takes me less than an angle of theta to get around OH. And so what this means then is I've literally put my CFT on a cone. I've created a deficit angle with this coordinate transformation. Now this coordinate transformation, I just want to stress, is just a calculational tool. Really what's happening is it's the effect of being in the background of OH that's mimicking the effect of living in some deficit angle. And so what we see is we're finding exactly the deficit angle behavior we expect from ADS, but purely from the conformal field theory. And we see that this angular deficit perfectly matches the expectation from ADS if we convert between delta and C and then G and M. OK, now, as you pointed out, there's a point at which alpha would become imaginary. So now let's ask, what happens if delta H is greater than or equal to this threshold C over 12? Well, if I look at z, and I work in Euclidean time, then z is just proportional to e to the t, e to the Euclidean time. So when I do this coordinate transformation, this looks like e to the I alpha t. What I have then is that w, my coordinate, is periodic in Euclidean time, and its periodicity is set by alpha, which is just set by the scaling dimension of my heavy operator. So now if I look at a very simple Virasoro block, which is just associated with the vacuum and all possible contributions of t mu nu, then I can calculate its form, and I find that this Virasoro block is exactly the two-point function for my light operator, but in some thermal background. Okay? So I took some four-point function, OH, OH, OL, OL. I calculated one contribution from it, the leading contribution, which is just known as the vacuum or identity block. And I find that it perfectly matches the two-point function of OL in some thermal bath. The temperature of this thermal bath is set by alpha, which is just set by the scaling dimension. And I find that this perfectly matches the Hawking temperature associated with that corresponding black hole. And so in the background, like basically the statement is that OL propagating in the background created by OH is just the same as propagating through some thermal bath. Yes. Good, yes, so I'll make this more, okay, no, yeah, I can just say it. So there's a very similar behavior. So in higher D, blocks were suppressed by the twist of their object. And so there's a similar sense into which, it's basically identical in the sense that these blocks are also suppressed by the twist. And it's just that the identity block and stress energy tensors or any conserved current all have twist zero. And so the identity block is leading in the sense that if I assume that there are no other conserved currents in my theory or no other twist zero objects in my theory. So if I had conserved currents or something like that, that would be a contribution in this limit z goes to zero in this like light cone OPE limit. But yes, there are totally other corrections to this that I'm ignoring. Or well, for now I'm ignoring. But does that answer your question? Okay. Okay, so like I just said, if I take the light cone OPE limit, z goes to zero, and I assume that there are no other conserved currents in my theory, then the four-point function, which I've written in this very suggested manner of just OL propagating in the background created by OH, is approximately the same as the identity block, which means it's approximately this thermal two-point function. So what this says, then, is that if I just include gravitational interactions, or the contribution of the identity block, then at long distances where this dominates, all heavy operators mimic a thermal background for a light operator in this specific limit, which in ADS says that all BTZ black holes, if I'm far away, are approximately thermal. Now, as I step closer to the black hole in ADS, that's equivalent to deviating from the z goes to zero limit. I would include subleading corrections, and then those could potentially break thermality. So let's ask about the other Virasoro blocks. What's their structure? What must their structure look like? Well, if the full correlation function is periodic, so if all contributions of all Virasoro blocks is still periodic in Euclidean time, then this would be a statement of eigenstate thermalization. This would say that even though I'm in the background of some dilatation eigenstate, it mimics in the C goes to infinity limit being just in a thermal bath. So what this corresponds to is being periodic in Euclidean time is the same as being analytic in my coordinate W. Okay? And so if I look at any single Virasoro block with twist much, much less, associated with some operator with twist much, much less than the central charge, then this is analytic in W. And so these contributions are also periodic in Euclidean time. But there's two worries. One, what about contributions from operators with very large twist? And then two, what about this sum over potentially an infinite number of blocks? This could have analytic behavior that's different than their individual contributions. So this we don't fully understand yet. But the good news is that there's a very, very similar issue in higher dimensional conformal field theories, where instead of studying the analyticity in W, I'm studying the analyticity in Z, which is related to periodicity of just taking some operator around the other. And so by studying the structure of periodicity in higher dimensional conformal or in 2D and in higher dimensional conformal field theories, we can learn about the analytic structure in this variable W because of the fact that when written in terms of W, these are the exact same thing as global conformal blocks. Okay, so everything I've told you so far about 2D CFTs has been in this semi-classical limit. But what about going beyond this? What about the corrections to this? So we want to study the 1 over C corrections to this to these results. So there's a recursion relation that was written by Zamolodchikov in, I think, the 80s that used a so-called C equals infinity seed to derive the general function for a Virasoro block as a function of, oh, I should have changed this. So these H's are just the same thing as scaling dimensions. Sorry. So as a function of the scaling dimensions of the operators, the central charge, and then as a function of Z. And so recursively, you can use this seed basically to expand this function as a series in Z. So you find the leading behavior at Z, you plug that in here, and you can just slowly recursively build up the entire function for the Virasoro block just as a series expansion in Z. When Zamolodchikov did this back in the 80s, he just used the keeping all the scaling dimensions fixed, taking C to be infinity, which is just the global conformal block, as our seed. But we can improve this recursion relation by, instead of using the global conformal block, use our semi-classical Virasoro block. So use the expression that we had in terms of our W coordinates. Then we can do exactly the same algorithm, and we can recursively derive the form of the Virasoro block as a series expansion in this new parameter W. Now, recently there was some work by Eric Perlmutter that was very interesting that basically made a good step towards doing this. The biggest issue which we're trying to think about right now and trying to understand is that this is a very inefficient expansion in the following sense. What I really want is an expansion in 1 over C. This is an expansion in W in the sense that I need to include contributions from all powers. I need to include, I can't just isolate 1 over C with the first contribution. I need to include the whole the whole sum. So being able to kind of resum this series or being able to isolate the 1 over C contributions to this series would be a very useful means of making progress towards understanding corrections to the semi-classical limit in ADS3 gravity. But not only do we want to go beyond the semi-classical limit, what we want to do is we want to study the corresponding behavior in higher dimensional conformal field theories. And so I'll give you an example. So instead of living in 2D, let's talk about CFTs in 4 dimensions. Similar to 2 dimensions, the expectation value of T, or T gets a non-trivial expectation value when I go to some curved metric. It just has some general known form. So I can again choose coordinates to eliminate the three-point function O heavy with T. So this is done, or we did this. This is very simple to do. The problem is the following. In 2D, we had Virasoro symmetry that related correlation functions involving one power of T to correlation functions involving multiple powers of T. We no longer have the symmetry in higher dimensions. And so generically, even if I choose coordinates such that this is eliminated, the higher point functions involving multiple copies of T will not be eliminated. And so what I need to do is I need to understand the relationship between correlation functions involving T and correlations and functions involving operators that are made out of multiple copies of T. Now, in a general theory, I would expect these to be not related. Or in general, I would expect these to be unrelated in the sense that it would be theory dependent. But what we're trying to do right now is we're trying to understand in what kinematic limits or in what classes of theories do we have universal behavior where fixing T totally fixes the higher endpoint functions involving T. So as a very first step, we're just going to study the Iconal limit of just two objects scattering at high energy, which will be associated with the exponentiation of conformal blocks at large spin. So what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is in ADS, we have a nice simple conceptual picture of classical fields, where if I have some heavy operator, the background field that it sources for some object is just associated with exchange of multiple copies of the graviton or of photons or of just some object T. And it's this exchange of multi-T exchange that sources the classical gravitational potential that I background field. And so the question is, for what class of theories or for what class of operators is there similar behavior in a CFT to where some operator sources a classical background field where the exchange of multi-T's is the exchange of many T's is just the same thing as just factorized copies of just exchanging one T n times. So are there classical background fields in higher dimensions, like we saw in 2D? So very recently, we studied this behavior at large spin. Well, like we had said way before at the early parts of this talk, behavior at large spin is very weakly coupled. It has a nice, simple, intuitive kind of Fock-based structure. And so maybe we would expect that the high spin operators TT have this kind of nice simple structure where they're fixed in terms of t. And so what we found is the following. We basically repeated the exact same argument from before, where we take some correlation function, OHOH, TT. We consider the exchange of OH. So these vertices right here are just the OP coefficients of OHOH with T. And by using the bootstrap equation, we can relate this to a decomposition of OHOH goes to these double trace operators, TT. And we can, again, look at a singularity in this channel and figure out the large spin behavior in this channel. And what we find is that the large spin contributions of these double trace TT operators are totally fixed in terms of the single T exchange. And in fact, they have a nice simple kind of exponentiated behavior to where if you sum all of these up, then you get exactly the single conformal block associated with T squared. And this, you find that this generalizes. So for n T exchange, you find that it literally just looks like 1 over n factorial, the exchange of a single T to the nth power. You can add all these guys up, and so we find that the large spin contributions of multi-trace T operators just has a nice simple exponential form, in the sense that if I can kill this guy, if I can pick coordinates such that I kill just the contribution of a single T, then I've killed all of the large spin behavior. Which means that if I study in this specific limit again, z goes to 0 and z bar goes to 1, where I'm highlighting the contribution from the large spin operators, then I can again kill all the contributions from T mu nu just by making one coordinate transformation. But the problem is that I need to understand other effects associated with the nonlinear behavior of gravity or associated with the fact that T mu nu has itself living in its OPE coefficient. So I need to consider very schematically exchanges that look like the form like this, where I have mixing between two T states and a one T state. This was taken care of for us by the Virasoro symmetry in a 2D CFT. And there's been a lot of work recently, some by Sasso Zhibodov and Juan Maldacena, of looking at constraints, causality constraints on these OPE coefficients. And so if we can understand how universal the behavior is of contributions like this, then we can hope to make more progress towards understanding the exchange of multiple T's and to understand the extent to which operators with large scaling dimension source a background field for operators with light scaling dimension, and hopefully make some progress towards understanding thermality of black holes. Okay, so let's summarize. First of all conformal field theories have a universal long-distance structure at large spin. What I just mean is just the statement that for every two operators in any CFT, there's a whole tower of operators at large spin with fixed scaling dimension and OPE coefficients. The low twist operators correspond to long-distance interactions in ADS. If I go to two dimensions, then heavy operators create a background for light operators, specifically through the exchange of T mu nu through the stress energy tensor in the limit C goes to infinity. Semi-classical Virasoro blocks are simply equivalent to global conformal blocks in a different metric. I can change coordinates and trivialize this Virasoro block structure into the nice, simple, known global conformal block structure. If I consider an operator with a scaling dimension less than the threshold C over 12, or equivalently an object in ADS with a mass less than M Planck over 8, then it creates a deficit angle for any light probe. If I instead consider an operator with a scaling dimension above this threshold of C over 12, that it creates an approximately thermal background for some light probe. And then lastly, the exchange of low twist operators like T mu nu iconalizes if I consider only the large spin contributions, which I can isolate by considering correlation functions in a specific kinematic limit, such that higher exchange of multiple copies of some low twist operator are just the same as the exchange of one twist operator n times. Okay. So what do we want to do now? Well, if we really want to understand this eigenstate thermalization structure for 2D CFTs, if we just want to study it in the large C limit, then one thing that we should notice is that transitions between distinct heavy states should be Boltzmann suppressed. So right now I consider the statement of just OH is my initial and final state, and I just have some light probe propagating through its background. But if instead I consider correlation functions OH, OH prime, OL, OL, then I would expect that these contributions, these kind of kicking a black hole and having kicking it to some excited state, should be Boltzmann suppressed just due to the high density of states with nearby scaling dimension. This is something we haven't seen yet, but it's something we're trying to study in 2D. Another thing we want to do is we want to understand how thermal these correlation functions really are in 2D. And the way to study this is to understand their periodicity in Euclidean time, or equivalently, their analyticity in W. And very recently, we've discovered that if you go to this coordinates called Mellon space, which I don't want to go into right now, but I'm happy to talk about it afterwards if people are curious, that Mellon space, which is just a different type of transform that I can do to correlation functions. You can think of it as just some alternative to Fourier transforming a coordinate correlation function. And by studying Mellon space is a very useful regime in which to study analyticity. So maybe we can think about using these kind of Mellon space techniques to study correlation functions in a 2D CFT to understand their periodicity in time or their analyticity in W. We want to find the corrections to thermality. So how suppressed are these corrections? Are they just suppressed like 1 over C? Does thermality persist at higher orders? And so we want to try to understand how to use this recursion relation to study non-perturbative gravity in ADS. We want to then, in higher dimensions, combine constraints on the stress-energy tensor interactions and the VEVs that Team UNU obtains in a curved background to try and study thermality in higher dimensions. One interesting idea is that we found a sense in which the CFT has a natural language in terms of modified metrics or modified coordinates. And so what would be interesting is to, instead of studying this in some perfect CFT, to add some UV cutoff, and then to see how the coordinate transformation you have to make varies as a function of this cutoff. What this is equivalent to in the ADS side of putting some UV cutoff is the same as just inserting some UV brain. And so if I can derive how the background metric varies as a function of the cutoff, I could hope to try and learn something about the Einstein equations in ADS. So from the CFT perspective, see if I can discover the reaction of the metric to the location of this brain or to the location of this UV cutoff to try and understand something or to try and learn something more concrete about Einstein equations in ADS. Another interesting thing is modular invariance is a very powerful constraint on 2D conformal field theories relating a low energy spectrum to a high energy spectrum. Cardi made a very large amount of progress just by knowing the contribution of the vacuum to make very strong constraints on the spectrum on the opposite side. And as we're slowly building up more and more structure for Virasoro blocks and understanding kind of the low scaling dimension operators more finely, perhaps that can lead to more refined constraints on the subleading corrections to Cardi-like results. And then lastly, there's been a lot of interesting progress lately on studying entanglement entropy and Renyi entropies by computing these entropies via a method of which relates them to just correlation functions involving these so-called twist operators. These twist operators have very large scaling dimension that scales with C. And so there's been a lot of interesting work lately on using the Virasoro blocks that I talked about today to study entanglement to compute entanglement entropy in a conformal field theory, which has an interpretation in ADS in terms of geodesic lengths and is a means of kind of like probing the geometry on the ADS side. And so there's a lot of interesting directions to go. And thank you for your time.
Relevant for a time limit, and then say something more than you guys did in your first paper about the semi-classical blocks in that regime?
No, good. So, so it's hard. right now we're trying to study. So I don't know of any other better way to do it than just by parameterizing these like 1 over C corrections in the sense that these are just corrections that are parameterized by H light over C. And so if I could get those sorts of corrections, then that'd be exactly what you would want. What we are trying to do is a kind of combination of this coordinate transfer. So not to go into too much detail, we can talk about it more afterwards. But you can use kind of these new coordinates to define like new Virasoro generators. In these new background coordinates, they satisfy exactly the same algebra. They just have a nice simple structure in the sense that they basically kill OH in these new coordinates. And so you can try and like directly compute these 1 over C corrections just using these kind of modified Virasoro generators as kind of a way of making progress. But that's something we're thinking about, but it's very premature right now. But yeah.
So in ADS3, you could also easily construct black holes that don't just have like mass and angular momentum, mm-hmm. but you could also add some charge.
Good, okay, yes, yeah.
So my question would be, then would you expect some periodicity condition that involves like a chemical potential?
Good. So I'm very confused by black holes with charge in ADS3 in the following sense. What we were hoping to find, maybe you know more so you can tell me about it afterwards, but what we were trying to do is we were trying to study, to see if we could generalize this to study like Reissner-Nordström type like BTC black holes. Apparently that is true. We were hoping that we could just add the contributions of, because conserved currents also have like a very simple algebra, like it's very easy to study them on the CFT side. And we computer those contributions, and it's like totally trivial in the sense that if you try and compute the Virasoro block that involves all J exchanges and all T exchanges, it literally factorizes
here
into.
J is just a Kakmudi current algebra that you're
yes,
adding?
Then you literally just get a factorization of exactly the same Virasoro block we got with a slightly modified central charge, and then a nice trivial just. Basically, an exponential of J.
Yeah, in terms of the energies, like the temperature is a function of the energies, should be something that is spectral flow.
Yeah, good. Yeah. So currently we haven't seen that. Yeah. So we're trying to understand that, but currently we haven't seen that. But yeah, I can talk about it more afterwards if you want. But yes, that would be a very interesting thing to see about studying other more exotic type black holes.
So in the last part of the talk about eigenization in higher dimensions.
Yes.
So there's this sort of simplified, you assume the Largeron structure.
So good. So if you do assume the Largeron structure, it does simplify in the sense that then it's very, very easy to show that the tower of double trace operators has a very specific constrained form. And so that definitely is like another very like interesting, I think, way to make progress. We were trying to see what we could say universally. But yeah, you're totally right. If you do some large N approximation for a higher DCFT, you can actually more rigorously fix those OP coefficients of T mu nu exchange in terms of simply T. So yeah, that's a good other alternative. Yeah.
So you only assumed large C in showing various things suggestive of BTZ black holes. But
yes.
we know that you very likely have to impose many more conditions on a large CFT beyond just the large C to really have semi-classical gravitational mm-hmm. background. Mm-hmm. Do you have an idea where you would see breakdown of your correspondence for generic large CFTs that really don't have?
So I made a couple of assumptions about the kind of the spectrum of operators in the sense that I was really just focusing on the Virasoro block. So our results for the Virasoro block should be a robust statement about. So the question is then, what are all the contributions? That would be the only thing in the sense that I'm somewhat assuming some sense of a gap in the sense that I'm trying to just isolate like the contribution of like just the identity, just this lowest twist operator. And
do you think you could reproduce, for instance, a precise condition on the density of states at various twists by requiring that your assumption that the lowest block dominate is good or something?
Good. Yeah, no, this is good. I haven't thought about this concretely, I would think so. No, this is good. Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, we should talk about this. I haven't thought about that concretely. But yeah, that would be good.
Any other questions? If not, let's end.